every day we get a little bit closer to the kind of expertise and the kind of experience we're going to need to go there. I'd love to be the guy walking on Mars. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located 129 days' travel by Rock 6 rover from the Black Point Lava Field in London, Ontario, Canada. Space missions, especially those that involve astronauts, are costly affairs. Our human explorers need extensive supplies and support if they are to carry out their missions, and their time spent in remote locations is therefore limited. As such, it behooves us to try and figure out ahead of time what equipment they will need and how best to use that equipment to answer our scientific questions about other worlds. It is an integral part of what space agencies do, and it is an ideal we get close to achieving with each passing day, as our opening quote by astronaut John Phillips implies. There exist many different kinds of tests that can be done more cheaply and more safely here on Earth. The largest and most elaborate of these tests are essentially space missions that take place on the surface of our own planet. Called analog missions, these dry runs test how all the systems that astronauts will use operate together and are a critical part of determining how we will meet the challenges of working in space by figuring out what works and, perhaps more importantly, what does not. Here at Western University, we have conducted several of these analog missions over the years. However, not surprisingly, NASA maintains several standing programs, including the well-known Desert Research and Technology Studies Team, or Desert RATS for short. The team runs field tests of human robotic systems, extravehicular equipment, and operations for working on harsh planetary surfaces. A long-standing member of that team, and its science operations lead in 2011, is Dr. Dean Epler, who sat down with our own Marianne Mader at this year's LPSC. A geologist by training, Dr. Epler's specialty is breaking down exactly what it is that a scientist does in the field to understand and explore a new location. By isolating each component, new and more efficient ways can be found to use astronaut time and develop techniques for exploration. In his career, he has also made significant contributions to the development and use of spacesuits. Analogs are important work, for as Harriet Martineau once said, "You'd better live your best, act your best, and think your best today, for today is the sure preparation for tomorrow and all of the other tomorrows that follow." We here at Western Worlds appreciate the insight we receive from all of our guests. Many of us are training to play comparable roles in our own professional lives, and therefore these interviews help us to prepare for our own careers. Tonight's music, Lunch with the King, by Thomas Newman, pays tribute to this sentiment. With that thought, sit back, relax, and enjoy tonight's interview.
Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Today we're going to talk about a lot of the really interesting activities that Dean's been involved with through NASA. I've known Dean for a little while. He's done many activities ranging from geological field activities to testing astronaut spacesuits. Maybe, Dean, we can just open up. Tell us a little bit about this background.
Well, I'm a geologist by training, a field geologist. And actually, I started out years ago as a person who worried about volcanoes. But I also had worried a lot about doing the moon. I worked as a very young undergraduate on the Apollo missions a long time ago. So I always had a bit of a foot in the manned space program. In 1990, I came to Johnson Space Center to start working on going back to the moon, potentially going to Mars. And at some level, I've been working on that kind of activity ever since. In 1996, a good friend of mine, Mr. Joseph Cosmo, and that actually is his real name, who was the lead spacesuit designer for the United States, pretty much. Got me involved in a program of spacesuit testing, and Joe's approach was that he could try to get me to teach an engineer how to be a geologist so they could test suits to see if they were good enough for geologists, or he could just put me in the spacesuit. And he didn't have to twist my arm to do that. So for about 10 years, I was the lead spacesuit test subject. I'd like to joke I was the lead spacesuit crash test dummy for a variety of advanced planetary spacesuits. And the course of that time, we got involved in doing a series of tests, which ultimately grew to become the Desert Rats program, although at the time it was Joe, myself, and about four other folks. Joe just retired this year after 50 years working for NASA. He and I like to joke that when we first started doing this, he and I could each afford to take everybody out to dinner at the end of the test without breaking the bank, and now we would have had to get a second mortgage out on our house, respective houses, to do the same thing. It's gotten so busy and so big.
You mentioned the term desert rats. What is that exactly?
Desert Rats, actually, it's like everything we do at NASA, it seems to have an acronym. Desert Rats stands for Desert Research and Technology Studies. It's a loose program, and I say loose, I mean that it's really more a definition of a series of tests than it is necessary in an official NASA program like Apollo, like Gemini, something like that. But what it is a relatively small number of engineers and scientists who have, on a fairly regular basis, gathered in Arizona in the desert and tested a variety of hardware and operational practices. And like I said, it started out the first time with about six of us. And I think the last time we were all in the field together, there was well over 200. Recently, this last year when we did Desert Rats a year ago, or not quite a year ago, we actually started doing something different where I took the science team and ensconced them in Mission Control Center in Houston, and we ran our part of the mission from Houston. But up to now, it has always been everybody went to Flagstaff, Arizona, and tested things and rovers and spacesuits and ops practices and hardware. It's a general venue to test gear that we can't do at Johnson Space Center and any other place for that matter.
Okay, so it sounds like you're really running these simulated tests in the aims of learning something about future potential missions.
Yeah.
What would those missions be?
Our focus has always been manned exploration activities. Although we have robots that we have participating in the activity, it's always within the context of a sort of an integrated human robotic operation. The target that we typically look at has been either the moon or Mars. And a lot of what we do is not venue specific in effect, as long as it's got a gravity field. There are other missions that you can train and test to, but not really effectively if you don't have the parameters correctly. So we have been largely a human mission with robotic support. And what we're trying to do, in effect, is identify those things that we either don't know how to do at all or don't know how to do well, and use a venue like the desert to test. And we do that with I don't want to say a simulated mission, because that simulation has a whole separate context within a NASA mission. But what we do is we basically establish a framework that you can use to operate under. So, for instance, in the 2010 test, the framework was two pressurized rovers, four crew members, 14-day extended traverse in a lunar setting. And we did the precursor kind of stuff, the reconnaissance, built mission plans all around that particular framework, with the idea that by doing that framework, we're taking the hardware and testing it within that framework. Some things you can test in a vacuum chamber. Some things you can test in your backyard. Sometimes you need a bigger, you know, more real estate and more people to test a particular set of operations. And that's effectively what we're doing. It's important to point out that you don't test everything on an analog. And you don't just go in the field because you go in the field and then decide what you do when you get there. You define a set of test objectives that fit within that framework, and then you test those. And some things you can never test completely. Some things require different kinds of test conditions. And my favorite example of that, I always talk to people about limiting the miserability. The Apollo crews, before they went to the moon, did a lot of geologic training, but they didn't do that geologic training in spacesuits, because the geologic training in spacesuits, the only thing you'd be testing or training in that case was how awful you could feel. So that when they were doing the geologic training, they were doing that training within a context that taught them how to do what they needed to do in the most comfortable fashion, I guess you could say. Some things they had to know how to do with the spacesuits on, like deploy the science packages, the limitations of movements in the Apollo spacesuit, made certain sample collection activities a two-person operation, because largely you could not bend over, and there are certain limitations you couldn't do, or certain limitations on what you could do, which meant that you wanted to rehearse those things to the point where they were second nature to the crew. In that case, they would put on the 200-pound spacesuit in a 1G environment and do the work. But that's because they weren't, in effect, learning how to do the geology. They were learning how to do the procedures, so that when they got to the moon, they knew how to do the procedures in the spacesuit. So that's an important thing that people don't always grasp, is that you do these operations in such a way that you understand what you're testing and that you're not testing something that is outside the conditions of your environment.
So with the field tests that you've been conducting, have you tested a range of these options where sometimes people are wearing spacesuits, maybe sometimes they're not? What are the different types of scenarios that you've tested so far?
So early on in the program, probably for the first 8 or 9 years, this is 10 years because I did it for the first 10 years as the suit subject, we tested with pressure garments. And we started out with one pressure garment, one person, me, and we built to where we had two different spacesuits and two different suit subjects. And in some cases, we would do paired operations. In some cases, there was an individual by the name of Keith Splawn from ILC Dover that was the other suit subject, or Kevin Groneman, who was also a suit subject that worked with me. And some cases we worked together on something. Some cases he'd go one direction, I would go the other. But we largely were doing pressure garment tests to study either, initially it was, can you do field geology in a particular spacesuit? In other words, does the spacesuit provide the mobility, the visibility, the conditions that allow you to do this? We later expanded to things like deploying experiment packages, driving rovers, testing rovers, testing the ergonomics of rovers with a spacesuit on, and things like that. So we did that for about the first 10 years, is did actually all the tests were with pressure garments on. And after about 10 years, we felt like we had pretty much used up the things we could learn in the field with pressure garments. And most people don't realize how hard it is to work in a pressure garment. You see spacesuited astronaut, and it looks really cool. And at some level it is, but after you've been in it for a while, you start to realize it's heavy, it's difficult to work in. And I always like to joke that 9 out of 10 people who try on a spacesuit once don't come back for the second time, and those are usually the smart ones. So the bottom line is, there are certain things you test with a spacesuit, and once you've tested that, you don't go test things that don't need to have somebody in a spacesuit. In the following 5 or 6 years we've been doing this, the tests have largely gone to integrated human and robotic operations, where we have rovers that we test with people in shirt sleeves. But often the shirt sleeves involve backpacks that are, I don't want to say mimic because they don't mimic. They are technical prototypes for the kind of information systems we would have on a spacesuit. And in this case, instead of hanging off the side of a spacesuit, they're in a backpack. But the idea is that they're testing imaging systems, the voice data collection systems, and things like that. The rovers we test in terms of their operational concept. And that by that I mean the rovers themselves move around the terrain like a real rover would. The folks live in them as they would a real rover, but they're not real rovers. You can't put a pressure, you can't pressurize them, for instance. They're relatively light versions of what we would make heavier to go to a planet's surface because we're testing the idea of living and working in these things as a basic concept, not necessarily testing them as if they were real. And that you have to go that way. But to build, for instance, a pressurized rover the size of a large SUV is a fairly expensive proposition. You don't build the full-up flight hardware to test whether that's what you want to do. You build a simple vehicle that allows you to test concepts without having to build it. Just as I said, like you test certain things in a spacesuit, and you test other things without the spacesuit, because the only thing a spacesuit does in those circumstances is make you miserable. I think the key thing about analogs is that you're always tailoring the test not only to test certain things that you want, you can't test everything, but you tailor the conditions, the hardware, to do the test accurately without getting overblown.
Let's pretend I'm one of your astronauts.
All right.
In one of these analog activities. Yeah. You've described that they're testing, they're wearing backpacks, for example. Mm-hmm. They have different pieces of equipment on mm-hmm. them. There's rovers. Can you describe what this would look like? Maybe someone who's watching this field test, or even how much gear I would be handling as this astronaut. Just paint us a picture of the scene.
So typically when the crews are out in the prototype gear we're testing, they look like they've got a backpack on, but there's camera hanging off the backpack, all sorts of the usual forest of antennas and things hanging off, as well as headsets so they can be talking to somebody. We've tested a lot of different ideas with electronic cuff checklists. We're trying to get away from a paper environment. The problem often is that paper is still a pretty efficient medium. So we test communication systems, information gathering systems, and all of these prototypes are essentially fitted to this backpack. So it would look like you have sort of a normal backpack, but when you unzipped it, it would be full of electronic gear, and there'd be antennas hanging off, and you'd have a headset on. And you would be working in proximity of something that looks like it's like a small Winnebago. It's not that big, but it's essentially a small vehicle where two people can move around the terrain and live in for as much as 2 weeks at a time without coming to blows or having to open the windows. Very often, the context, again, that we do these tests in is a geologic one. For instance, in 2010, we had about 100 kilometers of planned traverses that would extend over 14 days. The crew would proceed from day to day to plan stations, do certain geologic activities, and then end up the day at a certain location where they would hunker down for the night, live in the rover overnight, and get up the next day and do the same thing all over again, starting and ending back up at the same point, which would be a place that would either be a landed vehicle, for instance, or a habitat, depending on what you're doing there. The context has generally been geological because that is typically what we will do on planets. Consequently, the crews have always been made up of what we typically call a commander/engineer, and that most of the time has been an astronaut, a U.S. astronaut. Most of the time they are people that have either flown on the space shuttle or on International Space Station. They are usually either a pilot or an engineer, although we have had some scientists. And they get a certain amount of geologic training so that they are versed in what we're trying to do. The second crew member has always been a professional field geologist, drawn either from NASA itself or, in some cases, the academic environment. So we have a person who's the, in effect, the science expert, and the person who's effectively the systems expert. And that's very similar to the crew makeup that was on Apollo 17. And I think the best way to think of this is that you probably will never get to a position where you have two geologists on the crew, simply because the level of expertise needed to have a fully rounded out mission is probably beyond having two people who are geologists also being engineers, test pilots, drivers, et cetera, et cetera. So what you do is you have one crew member that has one significant level of expertise and a secondary level of expertise, a second crew member who's complementary to that, so that the secondary level of expertise for the first crew member is the primary for the second and vice versa. So, as on Apollo 17, where the commander was a military test pilot, he was also highly trained in field geology, was the first person to say he was the field assistant for Jack Schmidt, who was the lunar module pilot, who had a significant background in aviation, but largely was his primary job on the lunar surface was to be a geologist. So during the flight phases of the mission, he was Gene Cernan's backup and Gene Cernan's co-pilot. But once they got on the ground, he became the primary mission guy and Gene Cernan was his field assistant. And there's actually some good quotes effectively to that level from the two of them. We tried to build that the same way because it turned out the Apollo 17 mission worked very well and did all the Apollo missions did good science, but 17 was in fact the sort of peak of the operation. And so we've tried to mimic that as well. Now, sometimes we'll have two rovers. So in effect, we've got four crew members. And the way we deploy the two rovers is in some cases we have the two rovers working in concert. In that case, very often what will happen was we will stop at a site and have two geologists come out and do some field work while the other crew members stay inside. Sometimes we have one crew in and one crew out, and we just vary it. I mean, the bottom line is that there are different ways to do this. Often working two gives you a flight spare, so we test those sorts of things. Sometimes we'll send one rover in one direction and the other in the other direction to see how well that works. The important thing to recognize is that we're testing how we might do this on the lunar surface. The other thing to remember on this stuff is there's no failed test. We're going out to see how to do things. We don't know how to do things yet. And so on that basis, some things will work, some things will not work. The thing we always try to get people to get out of their mind is something that doesn't work isn't a failure. It's simply you learn that that wasn't such a good idea. We aren't going to do that again. And it's much better to learn it in northern Arizona than on the moon, partly because obviously if you find out something doesn't work and it's a life-threatening situation, it isn't a life-threatening situation in Arizona. It could be one in space. But the other part of the whole situation is when you send people to places like the moon or on shuttle or International Space Station or whatever, it's a non-trivial activity to get them there. It costs money. It puts lives in danger. We hope minimal danger, but nonetheless, there's no way to go to space where you aren't accepting some level of danger. You don't want to send people to space to find out that something that you could have tested on the ground and find out it didn't work, you didn't do, and somebody got hurt because of it. The thing we try to emphasize every time people bring hardware, come to the test, it's that there's no right or wrong answer. You're testing to see what works and what doesn't. And a thing that doesn't work is just as important as a thing that does work.
So looking forward to future human missions to the moon, Mars, maybe an asteroid, what are some of the highlights of the main lessons learned that you guys have gotten from these field deployments?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, multiple crew is better than single crews, okay? And multiple crew with complementary capabilities. As I said earlier, you're probably never going to have the luxury of having four of any one thing. So four geologists is probably not going to happen on a crew. And it may not even be a good thing to do. So there's a lot of primary specialties and cross-trained specialties. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we tend to think of the astronaut in space as the person that's doing the work. And NASA and CSA and every agency that's ever done space recognizes this. The public doesn't often. Is that the person that you see on the TV in the spacesuit or floating around space station or wherever is the pointy end of the spear, but you do not do this in a vacuum, at least not a communications vacuum. The team is everybody working on it. The more the team communicates, the better the outcome of the mission is. So situations, you never really have a situation where you're not having some interaction between the crew and the ground, particularly from a science perspective, which is where I've been focused the last 2 or 3 years, is that the science operations team on the ground is, in effect, the brain trust of the crew member on the surface. Once you get beyond getting your basic schooling and training, the fact is that you never are in a position where more than one brain on a situation is not something you want. The more people looking over your shoulder and helping you out, the better the outcome. So that having a robust capability on the ground of engineers and flight controllers and scientists helping the crew is really important. And we're a long way from sending folks out and then saying, well, come back and tell us how it worked out. And that just, there's a lot of reasons not to do that, but not the least of which is having the brain trust to help the crew members when they're out in space. And it's going to be a long time, if ever, if computers speaking to us is going to replace that.
And what have you found has been the most surprising result from these tests?
We just got done with a series of tests a few months ago where we were testing having an extended light delay time, which basically means that when I say hello, there is a considerable period before somebody says hello back. In our present circumstances in space, we're actually a little bit spoiled. We talk to space station instantaneously, more or less. There's a couple of second delay, but it's essentially a real-time communications. The moon was about 5 seconds away, but it was still possible to have effectively two-way conversations. Once we get out of the Earth-Moon system, we'll be moving into a realm where we don't have the ability to carry on a conversation. This year we tested what it would be like to have a crew working at a location that was 50 seconds one way away. So for every hello, it was a little bit less than a minute before they heard me say hello, and a little bit less than 2 minutes before they could come back and say hello back. We were not sure how this would work, and we envisioned it as being actually pretty frustrating, because typically you like to have conversations and sort of have this sense of interaction. One of the things we found was that it was actually quite the opposite. Now, I ran the science team, so the science team's job when a crew member is out doing some geology is to a combination of make sure they don't forget things that are important to do. The second thing is their job is to do that science interaction, to essentially be the 20 or so brains that can't be on the planet's surface. We figured that would be very frustrating with an extended time delay, but it turned out to be a lot different than that. The science team in the back room spent a lot more time taking notes and paying close attention to what the crew was doing. The crew, in turn, spent a lot of time talking to us, in effect, one way about what we were doing. It turned the mission into a much calmer mission than often you have when there's all sorts of things going on in real time. The other thing we discovered was that the whole process of some of these new communicators, I say new, they're multiple years old now, but the whole thing of texting, doing chat rooms and things like that is something that we have not done much testing with. And this year we tested using texting and chat rooms, and those turned out to be extremely effective, particularly for one-way queries. And we actually stumbled on using this literally in the middle of dry runs for this. I was sitting on console. We didn't have a full team. We were trying to help the crew get set up and do an operation. My cell phone buzzed, and there was a text from, at the time I didn't know it, but it was from one of the crew members out in the field who was 50 seconds off from me. And the text was, what is the IP address for such and such? It was a particular web link we were using. I got on the loop to the data guy and said, "Data, this is science. Can you give me the IP address for such and such?" He gave it to me. I texted back and then got a text back about a minute later and a half later saying, "Got it." The point is that if we had handled that in the communication loop, we would have tied up communications time. And by doing it as a text, it was totally invisible. The information went in both directions, and it got done a lot more efficiently. And right away, we said, boy, we got to try and use this more often. And they did. And it turned out to be an incredibly effective way of communicating without tying up communication loops within the room, without tying up communication loops between where you are and the ground, particularly when you don't have to have a conversation. We're discovering there's different kinds of data that you human beings put back and forth, and one of them is the what do you think's going on here, which is tends to be a more complicated and intellectually challenging conversation, even an instantaneous. But there's also the tell me this information kind of conversation, and that's something that can take place in an entirely written fashion under, almost you could say under the radar screen, from the verbal comms back and forth. It saves time, increases efficiency, and it turned out to be the way we did about 60% of our comms. Because it turns out about 60% of our comms was a little bit of what's the IP for this? What's this? What setting do I have on the camera when I'm going out the door? And it just made everything easier, and I would not have predicted that.
Right, and that makes sense.
It does make sense now on one hand, yeah. But we're used to, so we're very much used to being in instantaneous communication. Mm-hmm. We either talk face-to-face or we talk over the phone, or if we text, we text because we can't carry on a verbal conversation, but it's still very much a two-way conversation. We don't usually have to say underneath the radar screen, tell me how to do this, or what's your phone number, or whatever. And it does make sense, but this is a condition that we're in that we don't typically, you know, there's no place, you don't call somebody on the radio or call somebody on the phone and wait for 50 seconds before you know they've heard it. One thing that was sort of an amusing little anecdote where this, it brought home to us how long 50 seconds actually is. Yes, somebody on the street, how long is 50 seconds? Doesn't sound like much. So one of the first dry runs, we were getting the communication loops up and running, and we had some repeater loops going, which I didn't even know were going. So I got on, sat down at a console, got my headset on, and got on and said, EV1, comm check over. And then I started talking to the person next to me, and about a minute later, there was my headset came on and said, EV1, comm check over. And I said, loud and clear, how me? And the guy next to me cracked up because I had just talked to myself because it had bounced back. And in a minute and 40 seconds, which is what that 50-second time is, it was long enough for me to get involved in another conversation and not recognize my voice on the headset asking the question I had just asked out in the ether. So it became clear in little tidbits like that that 50 seconds, while it doesn't sound like a lot, actually is a lot. Once you get beyond about a 10-second delay between when you say something and get a response back, you can't have what you consider to be a normal conversation.
And just to give listeners an idea of what sorts of delays we would expect for planetary missions, what are the delays you'd expect for the moon, for going to Mars, if some humans are going to an asteroid?
Right. The moon is about 2.5 seconds away light time. So that means if you had a friend on the moon that you were talking to on the phone, and there was no interruption or no processing, when you said something, it would be 2.5 seconds before your friend heard you say that. And then if they responded immediately back, the total round trip time would be 5 seconds. Okay, so 5 seconds isn't that much time. Outside of the Earth-Moon system, the farther away you go from Earth, the longer it gets. When we go to Mars, a lot of it depends on where the Earth and Mars are on their respective orbit paths. But the round trip time is on the order of 20 to 40 minutes. So, again, that's a situation where when you say something, it's 40 minutes before, it could be as long as 40 minutes before somebody comes back and says, what did you say? Obviously, 40 minutes is a long time, and you could forget very much what you even asked them a question of. So that kind of normal real-time communications becomes difficult, and that is something that the respective space programs around the world have never had to work with, and we're just starting to get a sense of how we will do operations different. And that will be different, and it will not be like we have come to know with space station and how we did it on the moon. It'll be a very much, I guess it's more thinking about the difference between a conversation and an email or a letter exchange.
So what's next then for future tests that you're going to be running through these programs, either through the Desert Rats program or potentially even another analog program?
Right now, so we typically plan these things about a year ahead, or we do them on a yearly basis. That's the better way to say it. They're very intense tests. When I'm getting ready to do a RATS test, for instance, it's pretty much an all-year affair. We're digesting what we learned last year. We're starting to formulate what we want to do this year. We're starting the logistics, because logistics is one of those things that's really difficult. If we have 200 people and mass quantities of gear coming together in the field, they've got to all be there at the same time. So you have to ship, you have to get all the hardware there, you have to have spares, you've got to have organization, you've got to have a communication system that works. So the development of a particular test is very intense, and it's a little bit like a holiday parade. You know, you see the Rose Parade or the Thanksgiving Day Parade. You sit and watch it on TV for 2 to 3 hours, but what you don't realize is there's a whole dedicated group of people that, for the most part, don't do anything for the entire year but get ready to do that parade. So it's very intense, and usually when you're done, you feel like you've been in a combat situation and you want some time to recover before you start doing it again. So the other thing is important in this whole thing is we never do something twice. So every test we've ever done has not been a repeat of the test before, because even though these aren't as expensive as spaceflight, they're not cheap. And there is no point in testing something that we know the answer to. So there are a number of years where we have basically stood down and said, well, we know what we had to learn there, and we don't have any different permutations we can test, so we're going to stand down for a year. And that's pretty much what we've done this year, to the great, frankly, relief of everybody that's deeply involved, that is to actually have a year where you can take a vacation in the summer. And knowing you're not going to spend the month of September in Flagstaff, Arizona is actually quite nice. In a sense, we have taken this year off. We've done some other testing, which has been far more like testing in a vacuum chamber, testing in a mock-up facility to test individual pieces and parts, but not a full-up integrated systems test. We plan to be testing some stuff next year, but right now we don't know. We haven't sort of integrated everything together. And typically what this takes is a bunch of people sitting down in a room and saying, okay, what do we know? What do we don't know? What are we going to do next? And we haven't done that yet. So the plan is to do a test in Arizona in 2013, but we're just now starting to get the outlines of what we want to do. Some of the discussion has been, since we tested the one-way trip time of 50 seconds and learned a whole bunch from it, on how we do science operations and about how we do real operations, the mission control kinds of stuff, along with the science operations. The thought amongst a lot of people is maybe the next thing to bite the bullet on is a Mars mission, is to really try that 40-minute round-trip time. That will be a big test, because our standard thought of seeing everybody around the room sitting there looking at a console and the standard picture of a space mission that we've grown up with since basically since the first manned missions, doesn't work right. It just doesn't work right, because if you're sitting there watching somebody do that, you're watching something that did something 40 minutes ago. That may be something you want to do because you want to see what happened 40 minutes ago, but your ability to interact is zero. It happened 40 minutes ago. If you see something that's been done wrong, it's going to be another hour and 20 minutes before somebody can say, yeah, we caught that. We're not doing it that wrong, you know. So it totally changes how you run a mission. And the fact is, we'd like to do that, but we have no good ideas yet about it. And no good ideas isn't right. We haven't sat down and said, okay, how are we going to do this mission? How many people are we going to have in the room? Where are we going to do it? What's the mission scenario we're testing? What's the framework that we're doing it? And then do we have everybody sitting in the room watching what's happening 40 minutes ago? Or do we have a small number of people watching and taking notes, and then we have a larger number of people who at the end of the day come in and take a summary of what's been done and work the mission planning and work the mission control element of that, and then hand it over to the guys and said, here's what we saw you did today, here's what we want to do tomorrow, and we'll talk to you tomorrow night, or we'll try to talk to you tomorrow night. We'll do a 40-minute exchange tomorrow night. I think that's what we're going to do next. I think it's an exciting thing to try and do. It's a little daunting because it's all new. And one of the things we've gotten very used to in the space program, actually in a lot of our society, is having more or less instantaneous knowledge of what's happening, whether it's news, whether it's your relatives, what they're doing, even though they may be halfway across the country. It reminds me a little bit of my grandparents were from Sweden. When they got on the boat and left, they never came back. And they didn't call on the telephone. They just worked by letters. So it might take a week or two to get a letter. And that's when you found out what happened. But what you found out what happened was already over. We're starting to move into an environment like that again, where everything is an instantaneous. You don't know now what's happened the other side of the globe 5 minutes ago, because you can't. We haven't figured out a way to do faster-than-light communications yet. So
this is certainly an exciting time, and knowing that these preparations are happening for these future missions to the moon, to an asteroid, to Mars, that's exciting. I know that the public and listeners would probably love to see images of this and learn more about it. I understand there's a website.
There's a whole bunch of websites out there. The best place to go on that is to go to www.nasa.gov. NASA.gov, and then do a, well, there's all sorts of interesting stuff to see there about the whole space program, so it's not just analogs. But if you go in and start looking for things on analogs or do a search on desert rats, where the rats is all in caps, you get to see all sorts of things we're doing.
And I encourage all the listeners to do that. There's some great images of some of these rovers they've been testing and the astronauts and the environments they've been testing them in. Dean, I just wanted to thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We hope to hear from you again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
Listen to Marianne's interview with Dean Epler, who talked mostly about the Desert Rats program through NASA, which is basically they do a lot of analog missions. Pretty much just they're preparing to do these human exploration missions to the moon or Mars or beyond.
Yeah, it's probably the most extensive and comprehensive analog project anywhere in terms of operations and technology tests and all the different things that they're looking at.
So, of course, we at CPSX have done a number of analog missions. And I know, Raymond, you've been involved in most or all of them. So maybe you can tell us a bit about what we do here for our missions and what the purpose is.
Yeah, we run a series of these missions through CPSX in close cooperation with a lot of external partners. Because these kinds of projects, when they get to the scale where the work is starting to be realistic, you need a lot of resources, and so we've had to cooperate with industry, with the Canadian Space Agency, with NASA, other academic institutions that we work with. But we had, for example, a series of missions where we tested a robotic precursor scenario. You send a robot to scout out the area, and then the next year you send astronauts to work together with the robot to explore the site. We had a purely robotic scenario, and we had an astronaut-only scenario, and we were using so-called analog sites that have some aspects of the environment are similar to what you might find on the moon. Our target was the lunar far side, in particular the South Pole Lake and Basin, and so we were looking at Sudbury impact structure in Northern Ontario, the Kamistustin or Mistassin Lake structure in Northern Labrador, and then the Barringer or Meteor Crater in Arizona.
It's interesting that there aren't a lot of sites to do this at, so they get reused over and over again. Both Barringer Crater and the Sudbury structure were used for analog training during the Apollo missions.
Yeah, and there's also sites in the Canadian High Arctic, for example, where it's either very dry and rocky, cold, or where there are impact structures, for example, on Devon Island.
Mm-hmm. All right, I mean, we had Melissa Battler on the show a few episodes ago who talked about her experience with FMARS up in the High Arctic. So for the CBSX analog missions, what were the goals of the missions? What were you trying to learn, and what did you learn?
So we were looking at testing, first of all, how do you operate such a mission? You know, if you imagine, for example, international aviation, people flying across the ocean, there's a pilot flying a plane, but there's a lot more than that that makes that system work. You need to have air traffic controllers, you need to have meteorologists, you need to have people who are maintaining and supplying the aircraft and doing all of that. And certain aspects of that have been developed over the last century of aviation to fit the scenario of aircraft crossing the ocean, communication schemes and navigation schemes. But we have a similar problem if you're exploring a single crater site. How do you know where you are? How do you work together with people who are distant from you? How are those distant people in mission control organized to not only support the mission, but also to achieve science, if this is the goal of the mission? And so we looked at how to organize mission control and how to schedule the operations together between mission control and the field team, including the astronauts or the robotic assets, and as well, testing a suite of scientific instruments, advanced imaging systems and various geochemistry devices and other tools that you would use if you were trying to explore some planetary environment together with a remote support team.
One thing I found interesting that Dean was talking about was you mentioned communications. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, they're trying to simulate the delays that you can possibly get. And that story that he told where he kind of responded back to himself, because it's just not in your psyche, really, to have a conversation with a minute-long delay. You know, if we're sending people to Mars, it's...
Now 40 minutes.
40 minutes.
And, you know, he talks about how in the Mars situation, 40 minutes is something that just completely separates the astronauts from mission control. You can't send a message and have a conversation with a 40-minute delay or an hour and a half back and forth kind of thing. But if you have only a few seconds of delay, there's somewhere at which you can keep working with it. And there's also somewhere where it gets to be enough seconds that it's a real hassle. Mm-hmm. If I have to say something and then wait for a response of just, let's say, 20 seconds, that gets really awkward. It's not quite the complete isolation of the 40-minute case, but it's close enough that maybe you'd wish it was.
Right.
It's so distracting to have someone on such a short delay.
I think general people can relate to this by if they're trying to talk to someone on with the really crappy internet, and you say something and then you have to wait for the person on the other side to reply. And people generally get impatient with things like that. So people who are actually on such missions should be very patient as well.
That's right.
To wait for a longer time to get a reply from the mission control.
And it is possible that we may end up scrapping voice communications entirely for Mars and simply have text messaging. Are you at crater? LOL. Smiley face.
Yeah.
The intercontinental telephone case is a really good one, because that delay is coming from sending signals either through a whole lot of switches across the surface or up to geostationary satellites and back down. And that delay is just at the threshold of becoming really irritating, right? And yeah, so text transmission may be a solution. And that's not that novel. I mean, it's the first time that they figured it out for planetary exploration, but it's been used in aviation and in the military, and they're really looking at starting to do that, again, for the case of intercontinental aircraft.
That makes sense. I mean, the first time they put a radio on an airplane, all they had was Morse code, so.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for, you know, even teenagers these days are figuring out that there's some things that work well over voice, and there's some things that work well by just sending a short string of characters or a few words, because some communication doesn't have to be two-way. And
or,
so,
or instantaneously two-way.
That's also the case. Yeah, some things don't have to be in live time either. And so figuring out which kind of information gets sent how and over which system and when is part of what these kind of analog tests are all about.
So the fact that by the time we actually do get a human mission out somewhere, it'll be kids who grew up with these various modes of communication might be a great advantage.
Yeah, this is very plausible, actually. You know, we talk about how maybe astronauts and pilots are going to have grown up in the days of playing video games now, mm-hmm. and maybe that's useful for that kind of skill. But yeah, maybe knowing how to think in terms of sending text back and forth again.
Another lesson learned, I guess, that Dean was talking about was how different these long-term missions are going to be from what we've experienced before with the Apollo missions and even the astronauts into the International Space Station. That it's these, you know, to Mars, it's at least 600 days probably for a mission to go there and back.
There and back.
So there's a lot of things to think about when it comes to to that, just like you mentioned, you know, going on an Apollo mission, it was like going on your week-long vacation, and, you know, it doesn't change your life. You're just gone for a couple of days and get back. But when it's your entire life, it's going to have quite the effect on people.
There's a difference between a sojourn and a steady state operation. And the modes of organizing and sharing responsibilities have to change. You have to work these things out now before you put someone in a tin can and send them to Mars and figure out how to do it.
In the media, you hear a lot of complaints about, oh, well, people will go crazy if they're cooped up for, you know, a year on their way to Mars in their little tin can. But, you know, there are people who have continuously sailed solo around the entire globe, and that takes over a year. And they have done it in small groups.
Do they start out crazy already?
This could be. You may have to be crazy to want to do this, but it's also been done in pairs and threes and whatnot, and they don't murder each other. They don't go insane. And they do have communications, but again, they don't have instantaneous access to the World Wide Web because they have very low band rate satellite, if they can even afford that. And they have radio communications. True, but you're not supposed to abuse the maritime bands for too much superfluous communication.
But of course, they've also got fresh air, and they've got the sun coming up every day and going down every day.
Gravity.
And they've got gravity.
Well, we're never going to send someone out for a year and a half and expect them to land on Mars. They just spent half their time recovering before they could run around in the spacesuit. You just spin the capsule. It's not that hard.
Spinning isn't hard. Designing a spinning spacecraft, that's hard. But in any case, you know, gravity or not, you're not separated from the world if you're sitting on the surface of the ocean. In the way that flying in an enclosed capsule with fans and noise and beeping machines running the whole time, never knowing which way is up or which way is home, that's hard. And you know, who knows how long you can go out there without needing a bit of the touch of home. And there are other simulations, other analogous experiments that you can do. Isolation experiments like Mars 500, for example.
Yes.
Right. And I think these analog missions are more like answer to those people's questions saying, okay, why are we not going to moon? I mean, okay, we are not going right now, but we are working towards it. You know, these missions tell you a lot about what a person has to go through while the person has to get to moon or Mars. So it's not that we are completely stopped about dreaming going there. It's just we are working towards it.
Just that we don't have budget to do it, so we're going to do the next best thing.
Well, it's also a thing about being prepared, right? I mean, like you said, the Apollo astronauts just didn't go there, right? It wasn't just let's just send people to the moon. I mean, they had many missions, the Mercury missions and the whatever the other ones,
Gemini,
to prepare for that. And so I think this is the same step as we did with that. And, I mean, you're doing longer missions, so it's going to take you longer to prepare for these missions as well, I would think.
Yeah, and, you know, even if you have the budget, you have to prepare. You have to take these steps, and it's very complicated. You know, each of these analog missions, you know, sometimes you look at them and you say, how is that realistic? You know, they're walking around in the desert, they're not even wearing spacesuits. But you have to test each aspect separately, in isolation from the others, so you can understand what the contribution of each factor is, and also because it's a lot easier, as Dr. Eckler said, you can do a much better test four times in the Arizona desert for the cost of going once to the Arctic. And even if the Arctic might be a slightly better geological analog or have some other advantages, there are things that you can test very well in that scenario, and then you go test some different ones in Mars 500, and you go test some different ones in our work in Labrador.
So the desert rats weren't running around in the Arizona desert with spacesuits, but there have been analog tests with various kinds of spacesuits, which have led to developments of what sort of spacesuit we think we're going to bring next time we go to the moon or when we go on to Mars. These analogs are teaching us, and we will be much better prepared once we finally do get out there in person.
Yeah, and the key, of course, is going to be making these tests, figuring out what needs to be tested, and then capturing that knowledge, making sure that we recognize what are the important aspects of what happened and why it happened. Capturing that knowledge and then transmitting it to the people who actually run the Mars missions. Because the people who are doing analog tests today may not be the ones who go to Mars in the future.
As much as you guys would like to.
Yeah, sign me up, right? But,
which is another reason why we keep doing these analog tests. Having the fact, oh, well, we did an analog mission with Apollo astronauts. Why do we have to do that again? Well, because, one, the mission won't be completely analogous. But two, none of them are really active anymore. You could go and ask Buzz Aldrin, you know, what it was like, but that's not the same as having the on-the-ground training. Mm-hmm. And so we have to maintain this skill set, this knowledge, even in this time of this dearth of actual on in space missions.
Yeah, plus the technology and the goals of these missions are different than they were in the 1960s. And so they weren't sending text messages to the Apollo astronauts because they didn't do things that way back then.
Right, and even though they did send people with geology experience, that wasn't really the focus missions.
They had
geology experience. They weren't geologists, right?
Yeah. It was a crash course. But they got the crash course at least.
But that's enough for what Apollo's goal was. Apollo's goal was to go to the moon and maybe
bring back some fun rocks.
But if you really want to do planetary science, if science is the main goal of the mission, if that's the justification, then you have to have a mission which is differently organized than one which is there to plant the flag.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Marianne Mader. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and Parshati Patel. Our editors were Michael Forster, Parshati Patel, and John Moores. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.